All right, I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today. So at this time, I wanted to turn the floor over to Emmy Laiha to offer an introduction to this session. So Emmy, I'm going to add you here to the spotlight, and I'll turn the floor to you to talk a bit about the series.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Jean. So just very quickly, I want to talk about the Federal Facilities Academy. As Jean mentioned earlier, this is the last webinar for this series. We plan to offer and update these webinars about every 2 years. So if you participate in all of the 11 webinars and an in-person class, you can get a certificate of completion for the Academy. And Jean will give details on how to get your certificates for that in a second. But the program itself was developed for EPA remedial project managers, RPMs from other federal agencies, as well as our state and tribal partners. So it's really open to everyone who's involved in federal facility cleanups. And these webinars try to get to the nuances of federal facilities because although the cleanup is happening under CERCLA, it can be just a little bit different. So that's the goal of these 11 webinars. And I thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, thank you so much, Emmy. So I will just remind the audience here that they can receive credit for each and every one of the online webinars that they may participate in as part of the ongoing series. So again, there were 11 of those webinars. You can either take them live or you can replay any or all of them as archived version. And again, you can mix and match and complete any or all of the webinars in any combination of those formats as needed. These are open to the public. And then as Emmy highlighted, there is a in-person 3-day delivery, although I believe as Emmy was highlighting in other classes, I think they have done an online version of it at one point. So I say in person, but please know that there may have been situational requirements that required that 3-day or longer class to be delivered in a different format. But that was restricted to EPA states, tribes, and other federal agencies. So you could only attend that singular delivery at the time of this live delivery if you were in one of those focused groups. And as Emmy highlighted, you can receive a certificate for any or all of the online webinars. And then if you do all 11, no matter whether you took them all online, all recorded as replayed, or some combination of them, and you completed that 3-day course, then you can receive that Academy certificate for the entire series. So I'll cover instructions at the close of our session today on how you can share your feedback to get a participation certificate for today's course. But without taking up any more time, Emmy, I think we should jump right into the class, shall we? So I will turn to you to begin the screen share. I will take my video off the screen since I'm going to turn the floor over to you to officially start today's session. And the
Perfect. Thank you so
slides look
much.
great.
Okay. Glad to see that they're up and rolling. So we'll go ahead and jump into today's content. Again, my name is Emmy Laiha. I'm with our Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office at EPA headquarters. And today we're going to be talking about AERARs. So before we jump into all the content, I would like to get a better sense of who's joining us today. So a quick group poll, no right or wrong answer, no worries. But if you could just type in the chat what experience you have had with AERARs in a decision document at a federal facility. Is it none or a little, or you've helped identify AERARs, or perhaps you haven't touched them at all. And whatever it is, I just want to get a sense of how AERAR familiar we are on today's webinar.
All right. And
So,
Emmy, I'm starting to see those responses
okay.
coming into the Q&A. So remember, you'll be sharing your response to Emmy's poll question here just by writing it into the Q&A. Later on, we'll have separate pop-up windows. But for this one, you'll just type it directly into the Q&A and submit that response. And so as I scan through, a number of people have had no experience in this
Okay.
area at all. Some have been in dispute over AERARs. Others have updated them through a 5-year review process. In some cases, they were involved in identifying AERARs. Some have even helped develop the AERARs. We do have a number of people who have written DDs and RODs. Again, it looks like most of the people who have worked with them have either used them in their 5-year reviews or have simply have done that selection and identification process as I'm reading through these responses.
All right. So we have quite a spectrum of people today, no experience to had to go to dispute on an AERAR. So that's great. This will be either a great refresher or a first time webinar for you all. So let's go ahead and switch over to our overview. I'm going to ask Deidre to join us on video, introduce herself, and get us started with today's content.
Hi, my name is Deidre Lloyd, and I am, Emmy and I teach the 3-day class together along with a couple of other instructors, and we really enjoy that. Love all the questions and the input, and every time we do the class, we update it with additions or deletions with what you don't like, what you do like. So we're happy to see all of you here today. And I'm just going to give a brief overview for the first 13 or so slides, and then we'll have different people come on and we'll go into more detail later on. So the overview, ARARs and to be considered. So that's applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements. And there are three different types of ARARs we hope that you'll be familiar with at the end of this class. And we hope you'll be able to understand the difference between substantive and administrative requirements and how to document ARARs and then how to identify ARARs and then the procedures you go through to analyze the ARARs for use later on in your ROD and throughout the whole CERCLA process. And then we also hope that you'll be familiar with the six types of ARAR waivers. So we're going to talk about ARARs and TBCs. So why are ARARs necessary at all? CERCLA was enacted in 1980 to address abandoned, uncontrolled, and hazardous waste sites. And this includes emergency responses, removals, both time-critical and non-time-critical, remedial actions, and all the way to long-term monitoring. On a CERCLA site, no permits are required for on-site work. And the reason that was the purpose for that is to avoid lengthy permitting processes, applications, and then the associated fees. And all this was done to expedite site cleanup. But permits, even though you don't have to get the actual permit document or pay a fee, you still need to be compliant with the substantive portions of the permit. And so again, the reason for the no permitting is to expedite cleanup and while you remain protective of human health and the environment. All right, so overview, our on-site CERCLA cleanups, we must attain or waive an ARAR. There's no in between. You must either attain it if it's in the ROD or have a basis for waiving the ARAR. And they should be after you've identified them. And in your ROD, you must comply with the ARARs throughout your CERCLA process. In CERCLA, Section 121D requires that all site remedial actions, again, either attain or waive. Under limited circumstances, you may want to think about some local requirements that may be ARARs, such as maybe releasing to your local sewage if you treat groundwater, you know, that's been contaminated. Or if it's clean enough, that's something you may want to include. They're very site specific, so you have to consider your what you have going on site. And so it takes a little while, but the better you understand your site, the more able you will be to apply the ARARs. And there are many different sources for ARARs. You can use the Clean Water Act, you consider RCRA, Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, Clean Air Act. You may be located in a floodplain, and that's going to guide some of your decisions, or you may even have some wetlands nearby. Okay, so some of the state requirements. They must be, in order for to be an ARAR applicable, they must be promulgated, and all that means is they must be outlined in an enforceable state statute or regulation, and they must be more stringent than the federal laws, and they must be identified by the state in a timely manner. So that's the consultation process when you, if you work at the state and EPA and the lead agency, excuse me, had a brain moment. But anyway, so all three should work together and consult one another and, you know, discuss your ARARs, but there's a time, you need to do it in a timely manner. And the state must consistently apply or demonstrate intention to consistently apply this, whatever the identified requirement is at similar sites throughout the state. So there's also an expectation that there's some consistency even after they're promulgated. All right. The next one is to be considered TBCs. And these, by definition, are not promulgated. They're usually advisories or guidance that have been issued by either federal or state government, or sometimes even another agency, maybe DOD or DOE. And so these will be considered along with ARARs throughout the process. You'll look at your site risk assessment. Your risk assessor will assess, you know, risk to human health and the environment, and that will guide some of your TBCs. And then you determine the necessary level of cleanup. And the TBCs can be included in the ROD if they are deemed necessary, and they help to support the ARAR or determine your PRGs, your preliminary remediation goals. So you can consider them throughout the process, and they should not be promulgated. And maybe something that might be one you might think about is a fish advisory. And that, you know, you might have one when you start your site, but if you clean it up and go along, it may not be necessary to include it in the ROD because it's already been cleaned up. Or alternatively, if it's not, you may want to keep that fish advisory and then have some caveats in your ROD about, you know, how to handle it as the site cleanup goes on. A good resource is EPA's overview of the ARARs fact sheet. And then I think Emmy handed out some other resources, links. And so the TBC should be considered optimally during your feasibility study and your proposed plan. And then once you select a remedial action, then you can include your TBCs in the ROD. And your TBCs, like I said, you can consider them throughout the process. And some will drop out and some will be retained, or you may have none. But that's your thought process you should be thinking about as you go along. And if you include a TBC in a ROD, then it is also applicable, and you have to make sure that you enforce that and that you live by your TBCs also. All right, so identification of ARARs. This is considered very early in the CERCLA process. And the reason being, an ARAR may affect your sampling approach or some of the analytical methods or some of your method detection limits that you're gonna use throughout your remedial investigation. So the earlier you consider them and identify them as potential ARARs, that will guide your remedial investigation going forward. And they must be, ARARs must be site specific, and they involve a two-part analysis. Is it applicable or is it relevant and appropriate? It cannot be both. And they, again, ARARs must be based on site-specific circumstances. All right, applicable. Again, they're promulgated under federal, state statute, law, regulation, and they specifically address the contaminants on site, whether they be a pollutant contaminant or a hazardous substance. Sometimes they, you'll consider them, the applicable requirements, you definitely should consider them during a remedial action. But sometimes site-specific locations will matter, wetlands, siting, facility issues. And then the lead and support agencies will identify the requirements that are applicable to the release or the remedial action. And so applicable, you must always think about the substantive environmental protection requirements that are promulgated by the federal and state laws. And it's going to involve, you should involve your legal counsel early in the process too, because they'll help determine ARARs and write into your decision document how and why they're relevant and why applicable. All right. Some of the relevant and appropriate requirements. So these are going to address, if they're relevant and appropriate, then they're not applicable. So they're going to address situations on site. They're going to address some of your site-specific situations on site. You can look at some promulgated cleanup standards and you can pick some things out of there. But an example, like standards for your cleanup, if you have a uranium or a thorium processing facility, this is a good example. While your site may be a uranium mining site, so it's not a processing facility, some of their standards, you can pick out ones that apply to your site-specific criteria that you're dealing with on site, your uranium tailings or something. They may have some site-specific standards that you can pull out of there and use for a relevant and appropriate requirement. Oh, and a great example was that the MCLs, may not be applicable to a groundwater cleanup, but they are definitely relevant and appropriate. So always have MCLs. Well, always is a bad word, but most of the time, I can't think of an example when you wouldn't have MCLs. All right. Relevant and appropriate continued. A determination that a requirement is relevant and appropriate. Again, consider both. So if we hit this three times, you're guessing that it's important. So, and these are largely based on professional judgment, and your professional judgment comes in for your site specific, when you're going to apply these sites specifically. And the more you know about your site, the more familiar you are, the better able you are going to be able to compare the requirements with your site specific needs. And the following slide is going to have a comparison of some things you should think about when you're considering relevant and appropriate. So the professional judgment, as mentioned, is important, and you need to have a deep understanding of your site-specific circumstances, activities, and think about your remedial alternatives when you're considering your relevant and appropriate requirements, because they'll influence how you're going to address your contamination on site, what medium is contaminated, what substances are you dealing with, what's the purpose of your CERCLA action, are you going to do a removal, are you going to clean up groundwater, are you going to clean up soil? And these inform your relevant and appropriate requirements going forward. And so look at your alternatives, and you can, your TBCs and your ARARs may drop out as you go along and your remedial investigation matures. But for instance, and I'm not going to go over all eight of these, but for instance, a medium regulated by requirement, if you're looking at a requirement to determine relevant and appropriate, then you would say, it must apply to the soil if your medium is soil and it's contaminated at the site. If you're going to clean up groundwater and there's no soil that needs to be cleaned up, then that might not be the best requirement for you. And the same for the rest of them. So we want to make sure that whatever requirement you're considering, that it is definitely relevant to your site and it's appropriate to use that particular requirement.
Thanks, Deidre. One thing I want to mention here in the first column where we have the characteristics of the requirement, that is paraphrased, but it's essentially the language used in the NCP. And then in the second column where we're talking about CERCLA, it, just trying to get the language into something that might make a little more sense as you're considering your site. But we're going to go ahead and go into a quick poll quiz, if you will. Jean, will you take us through this?
Absolutely, I will. So I'm going to pop up a new window on the screen and let me hit the button now. You all should see a box asking you which of the following is not true of a TBC. Is it A, it is promulgated, B, it is not promulgated, C, it is considered in determining a remedy's protectiveness, or D, it can help determine preliminary remediation goals? You'll see a circle next to each one of those options. Simply click the circle to the left of the answer that you believe to be correct and then hit the submit button. And then that will cast your vote in. Meanwhile, back here, I can see the distribution and how many of you have voted. So about half of you have sent your answers in. Remember, this is meant to help our instructors understand where you are in comprehension and if they need to revisit some concepts. So there's no penalty for getting it wrong. Take your best guess and then hit that submit button. I think I have spent enough time here waiting to get those answers coming in. So I'm going to go ahead and close that poll in 3, 2, 1. And now looking at it, Emmy, it looks like about 2/3 of the audience picked A. It is promulgated. That is not true for a TBC. Is that the right answer?
That is the right answer. Yes, we were looking for A as the answer to this question.
All right, excellent.
If it's promulgated. And I it was like a double negative, so I could understand why people might have chosen B, thinking, yeah, TBC is not promulgated, but the question is if it's not true. So sorry if the grammar caught you on that one.
Excellent. And Emmy, we do have some new students or brand new people, and I just wanted to share one quick definition. If you're not familiar with the term ROD, or acronym ROD, it stands for Record of Decision. So please, if you hear a phrase or a term that you're not familiar with, let us know in the Q&A. We'll be sure to define it for you. All right, Emmy, go ahead.
Oh, but we have another quiz question, Jean.
Oh boy. All right, let me go ahead and launch this one. So you'll see a new pop-up on the screen. And this is a scenario where we ask you to apply your understanding. In this case, Site Y identifies a facility that was used for plutonium processing and is radiologically contaminated. Remediation will address contaminated buildings and soil. So we're asking you which of the following standards could be considered relevant and appropriate for this remedial action. And in this answer or this question, you can select all that apply. So you'll see a box to the left of each of these options. So you can select any or all. So is it option A, RCRA closure and post-closure performance standards for a waste management unit? Option B, RCRA requirements for tank systems, including response to leaks or spills? Option C, standards for cleanup of other radiologically contaminated sites, such as uranium and thorium processing facilities? Or option D, Nuclear Regulatory Commission regulations for low-level waste transfer or disposal? If you're having any problems with that Q&A, or pardon me, with the poll window, you can always type a response in the Q&A if that's the only way. But as I'm looking through here, it looks like about a third of the audience has shared their thoughts. Remember, you can check one or two or three or all of the boxes if you think they all apply, and then hit that submit button once you've selected your responses from those options. And I'm going to go ahead and close these responses here, as about three quarters of you have voted. So we'll close it in 3, 2, 1. All right. And in looking at it, it looks like the audience, about three quarters of them picked C and D, but almost two thirds picked A. So, Emmy, what are the right answers?
So the answers we were looking for in this question were C and D. Granted, A and B might apply. We don't have all the details of the facility, so we would have to consider those to see if RCRA closure requirements or tank systems might be included in this facility. But again, for the example and the limited information you were given in this question, we were looking for C and D. Since you have this radiologically contaminated media, it makes sense that C and D could be ARARs for your cleanup.
All right. Excellent. Thanks, Emmy.
All right. Well, I hope those questions were helpful. That second one was a little harder, right? Trying to get you to apply the information we've gone over so far. But we're going to switch gears a bit and talk about the different types of ARARs. So we have three different types. They can be chemical, location, or action-specific ARARs. With the chemical-specific and location-specific ones, those are typically identified early in the CERCLA process. So we're talking about as early as the site investigation. And those chemical-specific ARARs are usually health or risk-based numerical values. And with location-specific, as the name entails, you're looking at actions in a specific location. But we're going to go over all of these in more detail in the following slides. For your action-specific ARARs, those are identified during the feasibility study, which makes sense. You have to look at what alternatives are being considered to know which requirements may apply. So let's jump into each of these. With our chemical-specific ARAR, again, you're looking at usually a health or risk-based numerical value or methodology. And for a great example that we've mentioned already before are our numerical MCLs, maximum contaminant levels for groundwater that is identified as a potential source of drinking water. Those MCLs identify what's an appropriate level of acceptable risk, and those were the numbers you would have to meet in that case. Again, you have to also consider site-specific information when looking at those values. And it's basically going to establish a value that it has an acceptable amount or concentration of a chemical that can be found in or discharged to the ambient environment. So if there's, for example, if there's not a numerical value, like the MCLs, we're like, bam, that's an MCL, you know what it is. But if there's not an MCL that exists, then you're going to have to look at the site-specific exposure pathways, concentration amounts, and identify what the risk is to be able to move forward. Here is an example in a record of decision. This was a cleanup decision at the Travis Air Force Base from 2014. And let me try and get my laser pointer here. Oh, all right. So you can see this table specifically identifies it's for chemical specific ARARs, this section of the table. In the citation, you can see it gets very specific with 40 CFR part, ooh, it's a little small there, 141. So we're in your citations, you do want to get as specific as possible. You don't want to cite the entire Safe Drinking Water Act or the entire Clean Water Act, you want to get down to those sections that directly apply to the conditions at your site. This is a federal requirement in this example, and it's been identified as relevant and appropriate. So the description provides more information on why this applies, and then any additional comments the agencies perhaps wanted to include are in this column here. So this is one example of how you can do your ARUSH table. It can vary from rod to rod, but all this information, no matter the format, should be included. Here is another example of chemical-specific ARARs. In this case, we're looking at a state requirement. It's sources of drinking water policy, and this is from the State Water Resources Control Board, and it's identified as a TBC. So again, a federal requirement and a state TBC as examples. So let's talk about action-specific requirements now. At this point, you are looking at your potential alternatives, you're into your FS. So you're looking at technology or activity-based requirements or limitations. And these are gonna help determine how remedial action must be achieved. So some examples, if you have a remedy that includes air stripping or capping or injection of treated groundwater, there are going to be specific ARARs associated with those actions, all with the intent of protecting human health and the environment. So coming back to our Travis Air Force Base rod example, action-specific ARARs listed here. The requirement is regarding effluent requirements for discharge to surface water. That is in 40 CFR Part 122 that relates to National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, our NPDES systems, which typically require a permit, but under a CERCLA action, you do not need to get a permit, but you have to meet the requirements, such as effluent requirements before discharge. And here, this is identified as applicable because you are directly discharging to surface water, so it directly applies. All right. So with location-specific requirements, the name tells you. If you're looking at something where your cleanup is happening in a floodplain, a wetland, historical places, or places with sensitive ecosystems or habitats, you're going to need to look at these location-specific requirements. So restrictions are placed on the concentration of hazardous substances or the conduct of activities solely because they occur in a special location. These location-specific requirements usually may have a narrative description for the requirements rather than specifying a specific cleanup number. And this is where it becomes very important to consult with the appropriate agencies who can help ensure that you are in compliance with that ARAR. And we'll talk more about which agencies you should reach out to later in the slides. But let's look at an example of a location-specific ARAR from that same 2014 Record of Decision. So here we have an requirement for the Endangered Species Act that is a federal requirement, and it's identified as applicable. And again, that's looking to see if this cleanup or activities at the remedial sites must be performed in such a manner as to identify the presence of and protect endangered or threatened plants and animals at the site. So there it is, Endangered Species Act. So what about at our federal facility decision documents? When you're looking at that remedial process to get to a ROD, it really is a combined effort by your federal facility agreement party. So that likely includes EPA, the lead cleanup agency, which is the other federal agency, and your state partners. And it's not a one and done. As we've mentioned, this occurs throughout the CERCLA process from site investigation to issuance of that cleanup decision document in the ROD. So it's important to identify ARARs that are pertinent to the characteristics of the site, the specific substances present, and the potential remedial action alternatives being looked at. What I'm trying to say is you cannot simply copy and paste ARARs from another ROD that was previously issued, even if it's on the same site, because it might have different characteristics. The geology could be different. The groundwater could behave differently. So don't copy and paste an ARARs table that the previous person at your site used because it might not be right for what you're looking at. Keep that in mind. Another thing, sometimes we get requests for EPA to identify ARARs far in advance. Like, just tell us what we need to do so we can make sure that we're meeting it as a cleanup agency. And EPA cannot specify in advance for sure for certain which requirements will be ARARs for a site. Granted, some of them are going to be pretty obvious, but there are varied and unpredictable situations that happen. So EPA won't be able to say, oh, absolutely, this is going to be an ARAR, or this is not going to be an ARAR. You have to go through the process, and it's an iterative process, so it can change over time. Just something to keep in mind. Okay, it's that time again. We have a little apply your understanding quiz for you all.
All right, so Emmy, I am launching this next question, and we're going to talk about the scenario. In this particular scenario, you are considering an in-situ groundwater remediation approach for your site. How would you label the state's groundwater policy that the groundwater is considered a potential source of drinking water? Would you say A, TBC, B, applicable, C, relevant and appropriate, or D, none of the above? So simply click that circle to the left of your answer, and then go ahead and hit the submit. I will also point out that I do have a number of questions that are coming into the Q&A, and I just wanted to thank the audience for chiming in and sharing in their questions and comments. We will pause in just a little while and get to them, so keep them coming in. That's exactly what we want you to do with that Q&A space. Emmy, it looks like about two-thirds of the audience or so have responded here, so I'll just give them another few seconds, and then I'll count down to closing the poll here in 3, 2, 1, and let's look at that. So it looks like B got a little bit more than A. About a third of the audience picked B, about a third of them picked A, and almost a third picked C. So it looks like this was a stumper question. What's the right answer?
So in this question, we were looking for A. If it's the state's water policy and it's not, here we're assuming that word policy is the hint that it's not promulgated. So if it's not promulgated, then it can't be applicable or relevant and appropriate. It can only be considered as a TBC. So if people have information or feedback on that specific question, like, no, that's not how I understood it, feel free to put that in your feedback form or in the chat. That would be great to know. But yes, we were looking for a TBC on that one because it's not promulgated.
Okay. We do have a quick just definition check. Can we revisit the term TBC? What does that mean before we go any further?
That is to be considered.
All right. All right. So, Emmy, I do have a couple of people who are chiming in that in their case, state water board resolutions are applicable and their water board resolutions are promulgated.
Okay. Very good example. If it is promulgated, then it can be considered as an ARAR, not only as a TBC. So that's a great example. Maybe we'll have to put in promulgated or not on that question too for the next time around. Thank you for that. Now right. I'm going to hand it over to Deidre, and she's going to talk to us about substantive and administrative requirements.
Hi, again. Substantive and administrative requirements, what we're going to chat about quickly. So this is in reference to on-site activities and the substantive requirements, not administrative, but substantive. Administrative would be considered any fees or the permitting process, which we talked about before. So again, you have to adhere to the substantive portions. And these are three different examples. So a substantive portion of a permit would be, or any activity, you need to have a quantitative health or risk-based restrictions based upon your exposure to a hazardous substances. You can use the MCLs and establish drinking water standards. So one thing, an example of that is I had a site, had vapor intrusion, and we had to, there were tenants inside the building. And so our risk assessor had to establish site-specific numbers for that, for the people inside that building. And I erred on the side of caution, and because I don't know who they're going to employ. So I had it with sensitive with pregnant women and children, because I didn't know who was going to be on site. So that would be an example of your information of the on-site tenants, where it's sited, location. It's this is near, somewhat near to a water body. So those are all things you're going to have to think about. And we identified a vapor intrusion risk, which wasn't a risk until the tenants moved in, until the owner, a new owner, bought the property, and then he moved tenants in and rented it. So that we had to develop site-specific numbers. And then there are technology-based requirements, such as that you might have to use a certain technology to clean up a hazardous substance. For instance, if you have an incinerator on site, sometimes you have to send it to an incinerator. So that would be something that you'd have to include and consider in some of your decisions. And that all comes down to understanding the alternatives that you're going to entertain, and then, you know, and assess those throughout the process. There may be something that's a better way to dispose of it instead of an incinerator. And so that might change, and then you'll include that in your ROD. And then you have to consider all the Clean Air Act, RCRA, treatment and disposal. You may choose to treat it before you go off site, and then it'll be, you know, then it won't be considered, it'll be considered clean. It'll be below MCLs. So there's a lot of different things, but your technology-based requirements, it'll all have to do with how you're going to handle things on site. And then there are restrictions upon certain activities in some special locations. For instance, again, we're hitting on floodplains. Do you have any endangered species? Do you have wetlands? Because if you do, then that's going to be you have to consider any kind of permitting and make sure you adhere to the substantive portions of that. But again, not the administrative. Okay, so the administrative requirements, mechanisms that facilitate the implementation of the substantive requirements. So that's how you're going to implement the substantive portions of a requirement, whether it be a permit or any other type of requirement. Some of the examples, and you're going to have to seek approval from and consultation with administrative bodies. They may be in the city, in the county, they may be another federal agency, and then you're going to have to figure out how to document and report. An example is if you have an on-site system and you have to, for instance, you don't want the tenant to have to pay for the electricity that's being used by your thermal treatment. Those are hundreds and hundreds of dollars for thermal treatment. Or if you have an SVE system, those can mount up the cost. So you'll have to drop an electrical pole, and then you have to interface with the local city, county about how to drop the electrical pole, how you're going to get it billed. So there's a whole lot of things, but that's just an example. Monitoring well abandonment is another great example. You have to go, they have permits in many different states, but you don't have to get the permit, but you do have to find out the substantive portions and make sure you abandon that monitoring well as per state standards. And then you prescribe methods and procedures, and you're going to include those in some type of decision document throughout your remedial investigation about how you're going to address these issues. And offsite activities must meet both. Now, see the permitting and all the things, these are on-site CERCLA, because as per CERCLA statute, there's some things we don't have to do, like get permits and things like that, but we still have to meet the substantive but not administrative. But as soon as you go to offsite, then you're going to have to meet both substantive and administrative. You may have to get a permit to, you know, for treatment and disposal, or, you know, to take it offsite. You've got to adhere to the offsite rule and a lot of different things like that. So keep that in mind. And that's why a lot of people, before they transport any kind of material offsite, a lot of times they'll treat it before they transport it. And then it also cuts down on your landfill, you know, costs like that. So anyway, just a lot of things to consider throughout the CERCLA process. All right. And so when you consult with other agencies, that's always, you know, plan, make sure that you're consulting with the right agencies, and then all their sister agencies that they interact with also. The National Historic Preservation Act, you may encounter that at a lot of sites. That's something you always have to check in. When a site gets listed to the NPL, they develop a list of trustees, and we tell them this is now a Superfund site in your area, and we're going to interact with you and consult. If you have any concerns, please contact us. But throughout the CERCLA process, you should always be interacting with your agencies and making sure that their needs are met, their concerns, because there's different things you can do to prevent or mitigate any impacts. So the National Historic Preservation Act, they're mainly about cultural resources. And sometimes tribes will have some cultural needs that you need to identify and work with them to meet them. The Archaeological and Historic Preservation Act is usually any kind of federal projects in the area. And so you can interact with them and figure out their limitations, their concerns. And Endangered Species Act is a big one. And you always should see if you have any endangered species. And that's something you'll work with your ecological risk assessor on. And then the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, that's also, it's going to affect any nearby water bodies. And they work with DOI and DOA, Department of Agriculture and Department of Interior. And the Endangered Species Act, they also work with the National Marine Fisheries Service. So there are sister organizations that you also have to inform. And the Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act. So they have a lot of sister agencies. So you need to think about that when you're identifying any kind of these needs on your site. So there's a lot of considerations that go into it. And so make sure that you've interacted with their sister agencies and any subgroups or agencies and tribes. And every region in EPA has a tribal expert. And if you have any, the other day I had to call my tribal expert in Region 4 to see if this tribe, even though they're 2 hours from my site, to see if they'd be interested in coordinating with me. And she said, just let them know and then they'll let you know. So something to think about.
All right. So it looks like we have reached an apply your understanding opportunity. I will launch that poll question and ask which of the following are substantive requirements. And you can select all that apply. So you'll see five options up on the screen, and there'll be a box to the left of each one. You can select any or all. Is it A, consultation with administrative bodies, B, technology-based requirements, C, restrictions on activities in a floodplain, D, record-keeping processes, or E, issuance of a permit? So I'll give you a moment to just review these, checking off those boxes to the left of the answers that you think are substantive requirements, and then hit the submit button when you're done. About a third of the audience we're almost up to half of you have sent your answers in. I do know that there are still lots of questions and comments coming in, so I do appreciate everyone sending those in. We will pause in just a bit, but we want to encourage you to keep sharing your thoughts and specific situations and comments for your agency or in your area, because that will help improve future deliveries to the Corps. So thank you for all the comments and feedback and questions. Keep those coming in. All right, Emmy, it looks like about two-thirds of the audience have answered this question. So I'm going to go ahead and close it down here in 3, 2, 1. All right. And it looks like most of the audience picked B, technology-based requirements, and C, restrictions on activities in a floodplain. What is the right answer?
B and C are the answers we were looking for in this quiz. Remember, consulting with an administrative body, if it's for administrative portions of a regulation that is not on site, wouldn't have to be met. Record keeping processes are typically considered administrative, and permits are not required for on-site CERCLA activities. So just something to keep in mind. As always, you might have an example where that was considered an ARAR because of some site-specific circumstance at your site. But generally speaking, those types of administrative bodies, record keeping, paperwork, administrative type stuff does not have to be met on site for CERCLA activities.
Okay.
All right. So all now right, do you want to pause for questions here, Jean?
Yeah, I think we might have time, if it's okay, before we jump into the next segment. I think it might be a good time to stop and take a look at some of the questions that are coming in.
Okay.
So we have one quick question here. Are all state requirements TBCs, or are some ARARs?
Some can be ARARs. They're not all automatically TBCs. Earlier in the slides, we talked about whether or not something is promulgated, if it's more stringent than a federal requirement, and if it's being applied consistently throughout the state, are the factors that would have to be considered to determine if that is going to be considered an ARAR.
Okay. And Could OSHA requirements be ARARs? So let's say we're talking about the protection of worker health of around when they're doing a remedial activity.
My first instinct with OSHA requirements to say that typically wouldn't be considered an ARAR, but let me double check and I'll try and get a firmer answer before the end of the webinar.
Okay. All right. A lot of times
for the OSHA, that'll be something that you document OSHA in your HASP, your health and safety plan. So that's how you handle that. I haven't seen it documented as ARAR, but that doesn't mean it cannot be, like Emmy said. But usually any OSHA requirements are documented in your health and safety plan.
Thank you, Deidre.
Okay. We have a question here about state policy. So there's two sort of themes that I'm seeing pop up here. One of the attendees just sort of generally asks, can you define promulgated? Because they've worked in states where rules are written into state law with baseline risk levels and the ability to make them site specific. So the program is implemented for all releases for the state, but they still call these TBCs.
Interesting. I don't have the answer to that right off the top of my head. By promulgated, I believe that means that it's gone through the legislative process in that state to be, officially approved, but I would need to double check. As far as, from that definition, we can double check why it's still being considered as a TBC. Perhaps it's less stringent than a federal requirement. I'm not sure, but we can look into that.
So this is Deidre. When I worked at the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, they were developing, they call it Rebecca, but it's risk-based corrective action. And that has been promulgated. And so they had lawyers within our Superfund division developing the guidance. And then they would go and speak with the governance bodies, the committees, and on FDEP of Florida Congress and talk to them about what they were going to improve, what they felt. And so there was lots of back and forth, but they actually promulgated it through state statute. And it's actually a law within the state of Florida. And so then in Florida so that's definitely promulgated. So one of the things that EPA will talk with Florida about is have you consistently applied this throughout your state for remedial actions? And so that's the other part of that is, has it been consistently applied, or have you cherry picked and used it here and there and not other places? So I don't know if that's helpful, but that's been my experience.
Okay. And we did have a quick clarification regarding the OSHA question as an ARAR. One of the attendees was able to chime in and simply say that OSHA is not an ARAR per the NCP for worker protection requirements. So it's not treated as an ARAR, although those protections are there. Okay. I want to go back here to this question about state policy. So there's a question, if state policy is based on interpretation of state regulation, how would you handle that?
If a state policy is based on an interpretation of a state regulation, I would say, look at the state regulation and can that be considered an ARAR? Don't go with the interpretation, go with the actual reg itself. And that should be easier to meet the criteria of what state regulations can be considered as applicable or relevant and appropriate.
Okay. Okay, and then just a quick term definition. Can you define what you mean when you say on-site? Is it just the property, or in some situations, could it include other elements or parts of the property within a defined groundwater management zone?
So on-site, we have a whole webinar dedicated to this. It was earlier in our series, but typically on-site activities are anything that happened on the NPL site. Groundwater plumes are considered part of the site as far as the contamination runs. So even if a line on a map shows that's the site boundary, but groundwater has flown off-site, that is also considered a part of the site. And when you at our federal facility sites, they're very large. You typically have dozens or more OUs, potentially hundreds of waste sites. So usually anything on that NPL federal facility site, the national priorities list, is considered on site for the sake of that remedial action.
Okay. And then I just want to get to one other theme of questions here. And this is about substantive requirements. One of the attendees asked, did you say that those substantive requirements do apply at CERCLA sites? but that CERCLA sites do not have to comply with administrative requirements like permits for well construction?
That is correct. Yes, that is okay. What you were stating.
So someone else then said, well, the comment about not having to get a permit seems misleading. For example, at a Superfund site, when I'm doing remedial injections for in situ groundwater remediation, a UIC or underground injection control permit still needs to be obtained, right?
I don't believe a Deidre, do you have an example of this?
So what we've done, and you still have to consult with the agency to let them know, and then they can choose to document it as they see fit. So we consult with them and make sure we're meeting the substantive portions if there's anything that's unclear. But you still need to, I guess, notification for lack of a better word, but you need to consult and let them. For instance, if I abandon a monitoring well, I always, in Florida, you have to talk with water management districts. They're throughout the state. And we let them know that we're abandoning, we give them the information and how we abandon it, but we don't apply for a permit. We don't pay fees. Does that clear it up?
Okay. Okay. And yeah, we did have someone just comment that said usually the UIC permits are done through the state at their sites. Okay.
That's correct.
And then again, no permits are required for UIC injections, but instead you comply with the UIC class 5 well requirements identified as ARERs. That's how someone else has indicated you deal with this. All right. Well, I know we do have a packed agenda, but I appreciate that pause for Q&A. If we didn't get to your question, please know it's still in that queue. Hopefully we'll have time to come back to it. So keep those comments and feedback and interaction and question coming in for our instructors. And I will turn the floor back to Emmy to carry on.
Yes, I'm very excited for the next portion of our webinar. We will have a case study on Hanford with some representatives from the Washington State Department of Ecology and the Department of Energy. So I'll ask them to join us on video and I'll hand over the mic to Teresa.
Hi everyone, I'm Teresa Howell with the Washington State Department of Ecology. One of the things that I do for ecology is I work closely with EPA and DOE on development of ARERs for Hanford site work and provide some expertise on ARERs to the various projects in our nuclear waste program.
Good morning or good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jason Capron. I work with the Department of Energy at the Hanford site. My role is also working with CERCLA decision-making, coordinating with folks like Teresa throughout our CERCLA decision-making process for soil and groundwater. I'm gonna give you a little quick overview on what the Hanford site is for those of you who don't have familiarity with it. Hanford site's about a 600 square mile site in Southeast Washington. This was a series of production reactors and processing facilities associated with nuclear weapons production, which has resulted in multiple areas of significant soil and groundwater contamination. As I mentioned, that's it's a large site and it has already multiple existing planned records of decision. It's been in a CERCLA decision-making framework since 1989. And then there's multiple ongoing efforts to get more records of decision. So I'll kind of speak from that context. Go ahead and flip to the next slide for me if you would, Emmy. Thank you. So where it starts for Hanford from an ARERS perspective was with our federal facility agreement and consent order, what we call the tri-party agreement. This was I think we lost slides.
I am so sorry. Just one second. That's my wedding photo. I apologize.
Everyone says it's beautiful, Emmy. Just let you know.
Go ahead, Jason. Sorry.
No, not at all. So it starts with our federal facility agreement and consent order, which we reached in 1989. This is an agreement between EPA, DOE, and the Washington Department of Ecology. That's really important for us from an ARERS perspective because that's the launching point for a lot of the ARERS. The tri-party agreement identified at a very broad general level some of the top level state statutes and regulations that needed to be considered and reached an agreement between the three parties. That framework provided the first step for the first records of decision at the Hanford site, which were made in the 1990s, mostly interim records of decision, but some final records. That at that point, using what started in the tri-party agreement, those early rods built on that while considering the decision-specific context for each one of those decisions and adding generally a greater level of specificity. So taking that general identification that was in the tri-party agreement and then adding on details that were appropriate to the context of the decisions being made. we've continued to build on that. You know, Amy made a great point earlier. The last thing you want to do is grab a rod and just copy and paste and be like, it was good there. Let's just keep going with that. But nevertheless, as we continue to do records of decision for the Hanford site, we do look at what ARRs were identified for earlier decisions, either for an interim decision at an area where we're making a non-interim decision, or if there's a similar area next door and a similar media and a similar decision we're looking at, we always try and look back at what that context was so that we're not reinventing the wheel. But we put a particular emphasis on looking at newer revised regulations to be sure that things that have changed, especially since that decision was made or just that's kind of new on the horizon, that we're putting an emphasis on that and are aware how that factors into the ARR's identification process for a new record of decision. And then, of course, you also just have to consider those decision-specific factors. You know, that specific technology, remedial option that you're looking at in an area, be sure you're thinking of the factors that work through that. Don't take for granted that it was adequately considered in a record of decision you're looking at from 10 years ago. So flip to the next one for me, please, Amy. Cool. So for us, ARRs at Hanford, ARRs identification starts early in the remedial action evaluation selection process. And Emmy has alluded to this as just a good way to go about it. And we do document it throughout that CERCLA process. Typically, the discussions really start very early on, but the first where we see documentation of it is in our remedial investigation and feasibility study work plan. We seek to make a early identification of what the likely ARRs are. As Emmy said, you can't lock down an ARR at that point, but it's a good stage to be sure that you're looking at those general initial ones that will have key impacts, that you're factoring that in and thinking of it. You can then use that as you go through your remedial investigation and feasibility study process, that by the time you're getting to a feasibility study, you can have a greatly refined list that's based to the technologies and remedial alternatives that you're considering. And then, of course, the rubber finally hits the road in the record of decision. And throughout this process, in our experience at Hanford, you're focusing down the level of detail, obviously, based on remedial alternatives that don't get selected. Some ARRs may be deleted. They don't have an application. Or the specific details of the application of given ARR may get more clarity as you hone in on that final alternative you're selecting. There's discussion touch points throughout that process. For us, they occur as part of routine project interactions. Teresa and I talk with each other and others at EPA and Ecology on a fairly regular basis, just letting each other know what's going on, keeping in on things. And then there's also formal document review processes. As I mentioned, you see it that we included in our RIFS work plans and our FSs, which go to review by EPA and Ecology. So it gives them a chance to be sure that we're really all on the same page from a few levels. Thanks to the framework of those earlier key decisions and those kind of routine interactions we have, the process usually proceeds fairly smoothly, but challenges do sometimes arise in decision-specific contexts. So some challenges you could run into or that we run into certainly is kind of consistency and durability across multiple remediation projects. As I said, we've been making decisions at Hanford since 1990s, and sometimes applying the intent of earlier interpretations or agreements in consideration of changes to regulations can prompt discussions about what elements of ARRs are applicable. So be sensitive to that. You know, we always try to have an awareness of where agreements have been made and honoring those, but recognizing where context may have changed a little bit thanks to changes in regulations or specific application. Also, level of detail is sometimes a challenge we've encountered. The tendency early on in RODS was to identify ARRs very, very broadly, whereas we've gone more and more to trying to focus in on really the specific parts that are trying to be ARRs. That's a double-edged sword because it takes more time to get consensus on the specificity, but in my opinion, it pays dividends on the back end because you're figuring out and you're getting good firm agreement on what it is that's really your ARR element rather than a broad identification that really just leaves the interpretation to the remedial implementation phase. You're just setting up a problem for that stage. So Teresa and I spend a lot of time together working through those kind of pieces for what we need to identify. And the last challenge piece that we run into a lot is when you get into elements that are incorporated in regulations by reference, particularly when you have state regulations that interact with federal regulations, and that sometimes it's kind of like this regulation points to this regulation, which points here. How much documentation do you need to get into? That's a case-specific discussion to be sure you capture all the elements. Our preference that we've found works well is to go with simplicity such that you can follow the thread, but it is something that you just have to take the time to work through. Teresa, I should hand over to you there, see if there's other challenges or anything you want to speak to.
I think you covered it, Jason. It's really just a matter of timing and kind of weighing the risks and benefits of really drilling down into the details early on. Okay, Emmy, I think we're ready to go to the next slide then. Lessons learned. So thank you, Jason. The thing that we've really found, as Jason was mentioning, that is key is early communication. It's important to involve subject matter experts in those early stages of identifying ARRs. And for example, working with the state, oftentimes that includes other agencies. So the Department of Health, for example, will get involved in identifying air ARRs, even though ecology might be the lead regulator on a unit. As Jason mentioned, that early stage is typically the RIFS work plan. So you really want to be having those conversations early on in the process. We want to aim for no surprises once a ROD is drafted. There are instances where public comment on a proposed plan might raise issues, even legal issues that weren't pondered in the earlier stages. But the more you've had those conversations up front, the easier it's going to be to work through those challenges. At Hanford, EPA and the state of Washington have an MOU, that a memorandum of understanding that provides some framework for ARR identification and consistency. And we've tried to stay pretty close to that over the years. Most of the disagreements arise from elements that are incorporated into the regulations by reference, as Jason was mentioning. As a ROD is developed, the list of potential ARRs that you encounter is likely to shrink over time. However, that specificity within the given regulation might be increased as a remedy is proposed, refined, you work through some of those details again. Potential ARRs that are specific to a remedy or a technology that isn't selected will often get deleted at the ROD stage. And often what I've observed is that the broadly identified ARRs tend to get more specificity, including identification of those specific elements. Jason or Emmy, did you have anything to add on that slide?
No, not from me, Teresa.
I guess I'll just take a second to say, when I was a remedial project manager at Hanford, I had I worked with Jason and Teresa, and they are really great. The nature of your relationships with your counterparts at the federal and state agencies is so important. So you can talk about these things without it blowing up suddenly in a meeting, or, you know, having that email traffic of disgruntled people going back and forth. So I just want to give them props for being really good partners in the cleanup efforts at Hanford. And I would invite anyone from our webinar, if you have a question for Teresa or Jason, please type it into the Q&A. But I'll start with a question I have for each of you. Through this process, eventually lawyers are going to get involved. Can you talk about what point in the process your agency typically starts coordinating with legal for ARRs?
Sure. So I can kick that one off. We typically do not get legal involvement until we're actually at a decision document stage like the ROD. So if we're just looking at a work plan, we're typically only involving subject matter experts, unless there's a very odd situation, I would say, where we need to get some legal input earlier.
And for us, I mean, counsel's, you know, down the hall from me, basically. So we typically give ours the heads up that we're in, you know, that we're at that stage, let them know what's going on, gauge the interest. But really, yeah, that the earnest engagement for us happens as we're approaching the ROD phase. But there's awareness and preparedness before that. But where we get into legal reviews is really as we approach the ROD phase.
That sounds about right for EPA as well. Having that early communication with your legal counsel, regardless of what agency you're with, is important. I can say things get a little contentious, or maybe the pressure rises just a little bit when we start getting project managers, attorneys, management in the room. But the better, the earlier and more frequently you communicate, the better I think the process will be. Jean, do we have any questions from others?
Yeah, we did have a question that came in regarding one of the bullets here on the slide. So regarding that statement that potential ARRs not associated with the selected remedy were eliminated, why wouldn't all ARRs relevant to all of the remedies that were considered remain relevant?
Teresa or Jason, did you want to give your thoughts?
I can field that. So for example, if you had an ARAR that was related to subsurface injection for a particular remedial alternative, and you chose a remedial alternative that had nothing to do with subsurface injection, that ARAR element wouldn't have applicability anymore, so you wouldn't continue it in the rod. Those are the kind of cases where there's a deletion of it.
Another thing is throughout this process, I think that the more communication you have about it is really, really, really important to have with all partners. And one thing, like we were talking about consulting about UICs, we actually proposed underground injections, or DOE did, for Savannah River site. And after we sat down with the state and all the UIC section, they're not part of the Superfund branch, but so we sat down with them. We found another alternative because the state had really strong reservations about it. And it wasn't about permitting, but it's about the substantive portions of the permit. And so I believe we found another avenue, and but that was through consultation, and it took many meetings, but it all worked out. And that's why I think communication is so important.
Well, right in line with that, we have a couple of comments and questions that came in. So let me just read through these ones. A number of people are chiming in that they do recommend coordinating ARARs with other agencies before you meet with the facility and include your legal counsel as part of that. Because if you can walk in with a united voice, it's just overall going to reduce time to negotiate, especially if EPA is already on board with the state ARARs. Others are, again, chiming in that their agency works with lawyers who help put their ARARs together at the FS stage. And that gets to one of my questions. Someone else asked, I thought ARARs accepted during the feasibility or FS stage are accepted during the FS as that evaluates the remedial actions. And then it's the ROD that identifies the remedy.
Notice, though, in your ROD, a very important section is your ARARs table, which identifies specifically what requirements have to be met. And that's going to help ensure that the remedy is protective of human health and the environment. So you would only focus on the selected remedy for the ARARs in those tables. As Jason mentioned, if it's not pertinent, you wouldn't include it.
And Emmy, maybe to supplement that too, that if there had been a significant change in ARARs through your FS and proposed plan process, that really should be documented in your ROD, that change occurred across that too.
Right. I think Teresa used the language, if it wasn't previously anticipated, then that is something that merits a discussion in the record of decision.
Okay. All right. And then just a quick clarification that the NCP requires ARARs in the FS for alternatives, and the ROD must include ARARs for the selected remedy only. So thank you for that NCP reference. We always appreciate the regulatory framework as well. Okay, so I think just in the interest of time, Emmy, it might be time to move on to the next segment. I think we're just a few minutes behind, but we can make that up. So I want to turn the floor back to you.
Sure. And just another big thank you to Jason and Teresa for joining us today. We appreciate your input. And I will now hand it over to Deidre to talk about documenting ARARs.
Right, so wrap this up with our previous conversations. We're going to talk about how you document the ARARs once you going forward in the process. So the ROD, as we talked about, should document ARARs as follows. So, and I also want to preface this with EPA has a structured ROD document about how you structure your record of decision. However, when you work with a federal facility, they don't have to follow EPA structures for documents. A lot of times they have their own structures. And so what you do is, if it's not in, for instance, if your major So if your major ARARs are not discussed in a section called description of alternatives, you can make sure that your major ARARs are captured elsewhere. So my point is, you know, work with your federal facility. And if they, you know, they have sometimes structure is less important than content. So make sure you check all the boxes and that you've got the appropriate information in your ROD. But major ARARs should be captured in the appropriate section at EPA. It's a description of alternatives, and most people use that, I believe. And ARAR compliance should be summarized in the summary of comparative analysis. And that's a lot of times the comparative analysis you'll have in the ROD. And then, as we've mentioned, some of your ARARs may fall out when you have the chosen alternative. And some people handle that differently. Most of the time, people talk about why these ARARs that were chosen are need to be applicable to this site, need to be used for this site, and for the different requirements. But definitely all the ARARs that were for the selected remedy should be listed and briefly described in the statutory determination section. And so most people, and almost all the RODs I've seen, they have tables for the ARARs and explanations, and then they'll have some discussion after or before the ARAR tables. But the ARAR tables make it easy for reference, and almost everyone has tables. let's see. Did I miss anything? I don't think so. Oh, you need to, the record of decision should also include an explanation or a basis for any kind of ARAR waiver. And you need to have, if you have TBCs, you need to have a discussion of the TBCs and how they support your the ARARs that were chosen. And just make sure you explain and it's understood how the TBCs were identified and how they're going to be used. And definitely you should have this conversation throughout the CERCLA process, and you want to consider ARARs in your RI and the FS also. The proposed plan and the ROD will be summary part of the remedial action, and they should comply with the major ARARs and describe why the requirement is either applicable or relevant and appropriate. So that should be in your description. And the attorneys a lot of times will, most of the time, they will address that, whether it's applicable or relevant and appropriate and how it applies to your specific site actions. All right, ARARs and removal actions. Removal actions, those are, they can be time critical or non-time critical. Time critical, 6 months. Non-time critical is 6 months or more. And so the removal actions must also comply with your ARARs to the extent practicable. All right, and that means that if you can't, for instance, if you have an emergency removal, that's going to be different. That's going to have different ARARs than a time critical or non-time critical. Because if you have, you know, an explosion or something that's an explosive capacity, or you have drums that are leaking or anything like that, then you're going to have different ARARs. So if you have the leaking drums and you caught it, then, you know, maybe you only have to look at the soil and it didn't get into the groundwater. So what they would do is just look at the soil ARRs. And so a lot of times they'll just do a removal after they get the leaking drums taken care of, which would be an emergency response. And then that could go into a time critical if it was a large amount of drums. If it's just a few drums, they'll just do it at the same time as an emergency response. If it's a large number of drums, sometimes it can be over acres or, you know, in a whole building. So then you have to assess and you have to look at, you know, has it interfaced with groundwater? Did it even make it to the water table? If not, then you just have to worry about soil ARARs and the removal action. So the things that determine the compliance with ARARs, as we mentioned, is it practicable? The urgency of the situation, which would be an emergency action. And then the scope of the removal action, which I talked about, you know, acres, a building, or just a few drums on site. And so that will dictate how you apply and use your ARARs.
Just to jump in on that, Deidre, the box we have up here about definitions of these words, because we ask, well, what does practical mean? And that can be a discussion EPA, state regulators, and the lead federal agency will talk about at length. So these definitions just kind of help give you an idea. Practicable does imply that you're looking at the current conditions, like Deidre said, the urgency of the situation and the scope of the removal action. While something that's possible, I mean, it's like possible in the realm of all possibilities, so that's a much broader term. And then feasible being what's actually going to get you to your desired result. So those are not in the NCP. It's just to give you a better understanding of how each of those terms can be viewed. But definitely talk about that, right? Because my idea of practicable as an EPA regulator might not be other people's idea of practicable.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. For instance, if you have something that's going to release to a surface water, then that's of importance. And you would use different ARARs for the surface water because you'd have to see where it's going to be exposed, where it may enter that surface water. And if an emergency reaction, and if it's an emergency action, then a lot of times they will build a berm or they will make it so it doesn't, some type of barrier, and there's lots of different barriers. So you, it never makes it to that exposure point. So there's lots of different things, but then you'd have to deal with soil. If it makes it to the surface water, then you have to deal with surface water ARARs. If it makes it to the groundwater table, then you'll have to look at soil and groundwater. So, all right, so developing protective remedies. So the CERCLA 121 requires a selection of a remedial action to be protective of human health and the environment and to remain protective of human health and the environment. EPA's approach to determining protectiveness, we do a risk assessment. And again, that's you develop your site-specific contaminant levels, your contaminations on site. You see, are there any sensitive groups, children, pregnant women? Are there exposure timeframes? For instance, TCE can be a driver in vapor intrusion because it has a really short exposure time. I think it's like 30 days or something like that. And exposure timeframes on a soccer field versus, so you're also going to consider your reuse scenario. Is it going to be a soccer field where you just have people exposed for a couple hours at the soccer game? Or is it going to be inside a home? Is it vapor intrusion in a home? So those are completely different scenarios. And that's where your risk assessor comes in and they develop site-specific levels as necessary, or they'll determine, do you use 10 to the minus four, or do you use 10 to the minus six? If it's an industrial, you know, business industrial, then it's usually 10 to the minus four, unless there's some reason for it to be lower. And if it's a residential, then it's 10 to the minus six. And if there's any special considerations, we may even look at site specifically lowering it even further. But whatever you determine, your ARARs and your risk assessment and TBCs must be attained by the remedial action, and they must be protective of human health and the environment. And then also have to consider any multiple pathways and then any kind of synergistic effects. If you have multiple contaminants, that's another thing that your risk assessor looks at. And if there's synergy and there's interactions and multiple contaminants, then they'll also look at that. And you may even have an ARAR that's lower still. All right, when and where ARARs should be attained. EPA's policy is to attain ARARs and TBCs if they're important and necessary for your site and they pertain to either contaminant levels or the performance and design standards. And this is very important, all points of potential exposure. That's a very key concept. So if it's surface water, as I mentioned, if wherever that's going to enter the surface water, that's a potential exposure route. You need to consider that. Same with any kind of, a newly identified vapor intrusion route or an identified vapor intrusion route. So those are some of the things you're going to have to consider for ARARs and TBCs as applicable. You have to develop a reasonable maximum exposure scenario, and then you determine your cleanup goals and ensure protectiveness. So do you have a vapor intrusion problem? If you do, then you're going to have to speak with your attorneys and see about indoor air exposure numbers and surface water exposure numbers. If it's a surface water, groundwater, if it's groundwater, and at each potential point of exposure, you have to figure that out and figure out your maximum exposure scenario. All right. Exposure point consideration, groundwater has to be throughout the contaminated plume. That's key. If it's at a beyond the edge of a waste management area when waste is left in place. So the key is there throughout the contaminated plume. And that's again with the site definition. Your CERCLA site is defined by where your contamination is sited. Doesn't matter about property boundaries. Your CERCLA site is determined by contamination. So groundwater, it's throughout the whole plume. Surface waters at selected levels be attained at a point or points where the release enters a surface water. So again, if you have contamination that's entering a surface water, that is the area that you identify and you delineate, and that's where you have whatever tests that are necessary, sampling, and to determine levels. And air is the same way. You might think about air direction when you're doing this. And so you're going to think about if it's in an industrial area, then you're going to have 10 to the negative 4. If it's you've got a housing development just up the street, then that's a whole different exposure scenario. So your main key is you determine your maximum exposure scenario at each potential exposure point. And you also don't forget about sensitive populations, which children, you know, if you've got a neighborhood nearby, children, pregnant women, and all things like that. Daycare.
Right. Thank you, Deidre, for talking about exposure point concentrations. Those types of conversations come up a lot when you're developing your ARARs, so something to keep in mind. We're going to jump into ARARs identification and analysis. We're looking at the actual ways you can determine, is it applicable or is it relevant and appropriate? So let's look through these questions together. So if you're pretty new to ARARs, you're like, man, where do I even start with this? So some questions you can ask yourself to help identify ARARs are things like, all right, well, will this remedy restore groundwater, or is it looking at contaminated soils? If that's the case, perhaps you have to consider Safe Drinking Water Act, primary drinking water standards, if you're dealing with groundwater. These are not the end all, it's just a starting point, questions you could ask yourself. If you're dealing with in situ or ex situ treatment systems, do you have to look at air emissions under RCRA? Those may apply. Are you discharging to surface water, or is there emission into air from a treatment system? You might need to look at the Clean Water Act, MPDES permit substantive requirements, or the Clean Air Act to consider what has to be done. Or do you have a site that's located within a floodplain, wetland, or other critical habitat? If so, now you likely need to take a closer look at NEPA and also Section 404 of the Clean Water Act. A couple of other questions you might find helpful to ask yourself are things like, well, does this generate waste, like material that has to be disposed of? For example, it's being removed from an area of contamination, or is it still being actively managed? Are you leaving waste in place at a landfill? What about the remediation waste that you're working with? What type is it? Does it have PCBs? Does it have RAD, radiological contamination, excuse me? Or is there any secondary waste after treatment that leaves you with residuals that have to be dealt with as well? Or just how are you managing that waste? That's a big question. Anytime you hear waste, you're likely going to be looking at the RCRA hazardous and solid waste amendments for ARARs that all apply. And RCRA generally is one of the regs that provides the most ARARs in our records of decisions. Not always, but typically that's what we've seen. Talking about coordination and consultation with other federal and state programs, we've alluded to this a number of times. So when we're looking at sources of potential ARARs, we've talked about other federal environmental laws that are administered by EPA. Those might have to be considered. If you have a state that's authorized to implement its RCRA program, those laws, any federal agency administrative laws, there's a lot that can be considered. Also cases when you have more stringent environmental laws in a state for siting than you do at the federal level. And again, this is all to ensure that your remedies comply with the substantive aspects of the ARARs that are identified, and any other federal state program offices that need to be consulted should be included in this process, because they're going to be able to help you ensure that you are in fact in compliance with these ARARs. So with chemical specific ARARs, if you are looking at that, for example, the Safe Drinking Water Act, MCLs, MCLGs, the goals that are set above zero, or Clean Water Act water quality criteria, your WQCs for surface water, you're dealing with those ARARs again that are health or risk-based, and you're looking at what's going to potentially be discharged to the environment or remain in the environment. With action-specific ARARs specifically, you might be looking at RCRA closure requirements for Subtitle C and D landfills. We've mentioned the MPDES requirements for point source discharges a number of times, or the Clean Air Act, NESHAPs, for hazardous air pollutants, asbestos, and radionuclides. So anytime you're dealing with these types of actions, air stripping, capping, dredging, excavation, that's going to open up or, you know, have a number of ARARs that are going to apply. With location-specific ARARs, we've mentioned things like the Clean Water Act, the RCRA location requirements, meet the National Historic Preservation Act, Endangered Species Act. We're just hitting on these again because these are the ARARs we see very frequently used in records of decisions. So being familiar with these is really important. It's going to be really helpful. Just looking quickly at my notes. Okay, next we have a quiz to help apply your understanding with a graphic to go along with the questions. So Jean, can you take us through these?
I absolutely can. So I'm about to pop that poll question up and I'm going to launch it now. This is a select all that apply style question. So in this particular scenario, we're going to ask you in looking at it, where would action-specific ARARs apply in this pump and treat situation? So we have a well screen with, if you look in the lower left of the diagram, which is option A, you have option B, which is above the ground surface in that holding tank where your extracted contaminated water is coming out and going into. You have moving to the right and the lower portion of the diagram, option C, which is one of the reinjection wells, where the treated water has been pushed back into the groundwater zone. Then going back up top, we have option D, which is part of the treatment train components, where we have air strippers and granular activated carbon, or GAC, and that treated water is passing or coming out from that treatment train component. And then we also have option E, and I don't know why there's an option F, because I don't see the option F on the slide. It may have been a mistake on
mine.
There's
no F.
I got very excited when programming these in. I apologize. Disregard F, but E is the last one, which is that area where we're discharging to surface water. So we're going to point out on the diagram of those five, A, B, C, D, or E, where would action-specific ARARs apply in the pump or treat scenario? And it looks like about a third of you have set your responses in. These are pick all that apply. So you can check off the boxes to the left and then hit the submit. If you've already submitted your answers and F was included, don't worry. We won't hold that against you at all. But I apologize for that oversight. But you can continue to share your answers with about half of you having sent them on in. I'm going to go ahead and close the poll down here in 3, 2, 1. And let's talk about your responses. So it looks like by far about 80% of the audience or so picked C, D, and E. So those items on the right side of the diagram, your treatment train components, your reinjection well, and then the discharge to surface water. I mean, what were the answers you were looking for?
So the answers we were looking for were C, D, and E. So looks like the majority of our participants nailed it with that. With A here, where we just have contamination in a groundwater plume, that we, in this example, we weren't considering that something action specific. And with B, water in a holding tank, it might have various contaminants in it, but it hasn't gone through treatment yet. So what, we don't see action-specific ARARs that would potentially apply there, but definitely dealing with air emissions, reinjection of water, and discharge to surface water, those are all action-specific activities that would have associated ARARs. All right, I hope you all like that difference in a poll with a graphic. Any feedback you have on it would be appreciated. But we're going to go ahead and continue on with this question. Well, how do I determine if it's applicable or relevant and appropriate? Because it all sounds the same. All right. So there's a general procedure for this. You're going to look at your potential ARARs. You have to determine if they're applicable. If not, are they relevant and appropriate? Are there TBCs that also need to be considered in addition to the ARARs? And is an ARAR waiver justified in this case? So let's look at the process. What we're going to look at here is adapted from an exhibit in the EPA guidance on CERCLA compliance with other laws manual, but we're trying to lay it out in an easier to understand format. So we're going to go ahead and start here. We're identifying the pertinent facts concerning a situation at a site or OU. All right, so what type of substances are we looking at? Is it a special location? Who's impacted by this contamination? Do you have sensitive populations to consider, et cetera? What are the characteristics of the site? So you gather your information and develop that understanding of the site. From there, you go ahead and review and list provisions of each potential applicable requirement. So if there's certain substances, we keep going back to the groundwater contaminant example with MCLs. You know, those chemicals are covered. Is there a specific type of facility that needs to be considered, or requirements that deal with the sensitive populations you might be dealing with, or actions that are covered? So you start trying to list out that list just based on what you understand about the site. From there, you have to compare the pertinent facts about the chemicals present, their location, and the types of action or technology that's under consideration for the site. Once you have all of that, your understanding of the site and what that might mean as far as potential ARARs go, you're going to ask yourself, are all the provisions for requirements met? When you're looking down at that section of the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, whatever it may be, are all the pertinent provisions met? Does your site check them all off? Like, oh yeah, we have groundwater contamination. Oh yeah, it's a source of drinking water. The Safe Drinking Water Act MCLs apply. That's the easiest example, but there are many more. If the answer is no, say you have groundwater contamination, but it is not a source of potential or actual drinking water, perhaps your answer is no. Like, oh, okay. Well, then you would go to the procedure for determining if it is relevant and appropriate. If your answer is yes, you've met all the pertinent portions of that requirement, then it's applicable. So that's your step one. But if you landed here in the no, you still have to determine if something is relevant and appropriate. I saw some people asking, well, what's the difference? The difference in it being applicable is that all pertinent provisions of that requirement apply to your site. They're all met. So that's a big difference, but they might not all be met. That's why this no step is here. So let's go to the next series of steps. So say it's not applicable, but you're trying to figure out if it's relevant and appropriate. So you're going to review the factors to determine if it's sufficiently similar to your site situation to be considered relevant and appropriate. So we mentioned these factors before, the factors relating to the requirement itself and how it relates to what's going on at your site. So you'll look at these different criteria to help determine if it's relevant and appropriate. For example, what is the purpose of the program? Okay, is it to protect drinking water? Is it to protect sediments? Is it to what have you, whatever the requirement may be, and does that apply to your site? Is the use of that requirement consistent with the purpose of the regulation? Which entities are affected? What other circumstances are happening at your site where you say, oh yeah, this could be important information. It's not applicable exactly, but we should be considering this moving forward. So you go through all those factors. And remember, it's not black and white. It is solely mostly based on professional judgment. So if you think it's hard to figure out which ARARs apply, well, I don't blame you, because there's not just a clear answer. So once you're going through all this information, refine that comparison, really look, okay, what am I dealing with at my site? What substance am I dealing with? What media am I dealing with? Do the circumstances of my site and of the release at my site really meet some of the aspects of the ARAR that you're considering? From there, you ask that question, based on consideration of all these factors, is the requirement both relevant and appropriate? If the answer is no, it might just be the requirement is not relevant and appropriate, so it's not an ARAR. However, before you jump to that red box, consider what if you subdivided the requirement? Is it that it's not meeting all the requirements because it's too large? Do you have the scope small enough for the specific section of that regulation you're looking at to determine if it may be sufficiently similar to what's happening at your site? If it is, then you start all over, divide it up into that smaller section and go through your considerations again. However, if you say, yes, it's meeting all these factors, or based on these factors, it's met a majority of them, it makes sense to have this as a relevant and appropriate requirement. So what does that mean? Let's look at a little example where you can apply your understanding. We got our little graphic here. This blue line is the site. You can see there's some soil disturbing and fencing activities happening here that could impact the entire site. And we know there's endangered species found in these forested areas. All right, Jean, can you take us through the question?
Absolutely. So I'm going to launch this poll window, and there's two questions that we're going to ask for this particular graphic. And I'll just note, you may need to scroll up and down in the poll window to read the full set of options for each one. And if it's blocking anything, that window can be moved around and also resized, just like any other application window as needed. So feel free to pick it up and drag it around and resize it as needed. All right, so that first question will ask, how should the Endangered Species Act be considered for this site? Should it be A, applicable, B, relevant and appropriate, C, TBC, or D, should not be considered? And then if you scroll down in the pop-up, you'll see our second question. What type of ARR should the Endangered Species Act be identified as? And is it A, chemical specific, B, location specific, or C, action specific? And again, once you've clicked the circle to the left of the answer that you think is correct for each of those two questions, you can hit the submit button. It looks like almost 40% of you have sent your votes on in. Again, if you're having any trouble, you can also just chime in your thoughts into the Q&A. I mean, I am starting to see some responses and feedback from your question earlier. People seem to like the picture-based questions better. So okay. They said they like the graphics, at least that's what I'm starting to see, but we'll take a look at the feedback and confirm that that is a consistent trend. All right. It looks like about 2/3 of you have voted. So I'm going to go ahead and close this poll in 3, 2, 1, and let's look at those results together. So our first question, Emmy, about half of the audience thought it should be considered applicable, the Endangered Species Act, but a number of people also felt it could be relevant and appropriate. And then it was sort of an overwhelming response, about 83% picked location-specific type of ARR for question two. So what were the right answers?
So the right answers for question one, the Endangered Species Act should be considered applicable. It would check off all the pertinent portions of the Endangered Species Act because we have endangered species directly next to the site. So question two, I think it was kind of a gave you a hint for how to answer question one, but the Endangered Species Act is a federal location-specific ARAR. So B would be the right answer there. Okay. We'll go ahead and we have one more question. Let's jump on the next one just for the sake of time. With this example, you see our on-site groundwater treatment system in effect, contaminated groundwater extraction, treatment, and then discharge to surface water. Will you take us through these questions, Jean?
Absolutely. So I'm about to launch the next set of questions. Again, we have two questions for this particular graphic. You can move it around and resize it as needed. So in this case, where we have on-site groundwater treatment and the remedy includes direct discharge to a surface water body, which federal regulations would be considered an ARAR for this site? And in this first question, you can select multiple answers, so you can pick one or all that apply. Would it be A, RCRA, B, Clean Water Act, C, Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act, or D, the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act? And once you've answered that question, you can scroll down to the second one, which asks which subpart of the federal regulation identified should be considered an ARAR for this site. Again, this is a multiple choice style question, so you can pick any or all. And for that second question, you have option A, Clean Water Act indirect discharge requirements, B, Clean Water Act Section 404 regarding dredged materials. We have our Clean Water Act National Pollutant Discharge Elimination, that's C, and then we have D, the Clean Water Act Section 103 on marine protection. And I apologize, it was trimmed off here. I want to make sure I read that full option to them. Option D was the Marine Protection Research and Sanctuaries Act regarding ocean discharge. I apologize if that one was cut off a bit. All right, so once you've clicked your answers and then you hit the submit button, we'll take a quick look at the responses before carrying on with our session. Okay. And Emmy, I'm starting to see a trend here. And I think we may have tipped our hat to the first question based on the answers for the second question. And I think they're starting to pick up on that as I'm looking at the answers coming in. But I see about almost two-thirds have voted. So I'm going to go ahead and close this set of questions down here in 3, 2, 1. And let's share those results. So for our first question, asking which federal regulations could be considered an ARAR, overwhelmingly everybody picked B, the, the Clean Water Act. But about half of the audience thought C could be Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act. And then a number of people also felt that the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act could be an ARAR here.
So for question one, we were looking for the Clean Water Act. I think everyone got that. And C, the Fish and Wild Fish Coordination Act. I could see if this stream fed into a wild or scenic river, perhaps that could apply as well, but we were looking for B and C here.
Okay. And then for that second question, it looks overwhelmingly like the audience picked C, the Clean Water Act National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System or NPDES permit requirements.
Yes, this is a direct point of discharge to a surface water body. So we were looking for C. Great job, everybody.
All right.
Okay, so I know we're quickly running out of time, so I am going to hit the last of our slides as efficiently as possible to close out our course. So let's transition now to points of compliance. We touched on this a little bit already, but I think it's important that we go into a little more detail. So with groundwater points of compliance, again, we're looking at attaining remediation levels that are established on your site-specific information, whatever those circumstances may be, and also remediation levels that are identified, be it a numerical value that's an MCL or other types of determined cleanup levels, it needs to be attained throughout the plume or at the boundary of a waste management area. Some arguments I've heard regarding this is, oh, well, why should it be throughout the entire plume? No one's ever going to drink this water. The federal agency is going to own the land in perpetuity. So why would we spend millions upon millions of dollars to clean up this groundwater? And it's not that EPA is being difficult. Oftentimes, EPA's guidance and policy, especially for groundwater, is based on language from the NCP. So we don't have flexibility. When I say we, I mean EPA as a regulatory agency may not have flexibility on what is being requested for a site. So that's just something to keep in mind. Another requirement that I just want to point out to everybody is for federal facilities, actually for all our Superfund cleanups, is the requirement that no department, agency, or instrumentality of the U.S. can adopt guidelines, rules, or regulations or criteria which are inconsistent with the guidelines, rules, and regulations of EPA. So that is required to be met. And again, that language does not allow for flexibility in its interpretation. So coming back to groundwater, the reasons why it has to be attained throughout the plume, and again, knowing that different areas of the plume might reach remediation levels at different times, your leading edge versus the upgradient area near the source, you might not all have the same time frame across the plume. With surface water POCs, we're looking at those levels that should be attained at the point of release, that point of discharge, very easy to identify, just like we did in our sample question a little while ago. And air POCs, when you're looking at selecting those levels for the maximum exposed individual, considering the use of the site and the surrounding area. Are there houses nearby? Is it commercial areas? Are there schools or daycares, as Deidre mentioned? Do you have to work with your Department of Health with the air emissions to identify what those levels should look like? Likely so. So if you're doing anything like excavation, incineration, or even air stripping in your groundwater treatment, then you need to look at those emissions. Now, what everyone I think might be excited to talk about are CERCLA ARAR waivers. So Section 121D of CERCLA requires that on-site remedial actions either attain or waive ARARs upon completion. And we've already mentioned that off-site activities have to comply with both substantive and administrative requirements if they're off-site. The statutory requirement that a remedy be protective cannot be waived. Like, that cannot go away. But when it comes to a waiver, you have to invoke a waiver for each ARAR that will not be attained. It's not just a blank ticket to not meet multiple ARARs. Each one has to be considered separately. With documentation of waivers, you need to have in your CERCLA proposed plan a summary explanation of why the waiver is being proposed, and also allow for public comment to happen on that proposed waiver and its justification. The public needs the opportunity to weigh in on that. And once, say, it is approved in the ROD, that justification needs to be explained in detail and the specific waiver invoked for that specific requirement should be explained. So there are six ARAR waivers, but for federal facilities, we look at the first five. Really, I'm going to go ahead and skip the group poll just for the sake of time. Sorry about that. So interim measures, I would say this is one of the most used ARAR waivers. If you have an interim remedial action, you can say, okay, this is an interim action. We're not going to attain MCLs, but it will help reduce contaminant concentrations, or it will help with controlling the flow of groundwater to support a future remedial action. So perhaps you're not going to meet MCLs for this pump and treat remedy selected for a hot zone in a groundwater plume. If it's an interim measure and there will be a final ROD that will meet, for example, MCLs in the future, you can explain that in your document. But again, this should all be in line with the site plan for the cleanup of the entire site. We also have the greater risk waiver. I have only seen this used two times in the history of the federal facilities program. And this is when complying with a requirement would actually result in greater risk to human health and the environment, including workers, site workers, than other alternative options. So the example here is one of the two that I mentioned. Say, conducting land disposal requirements to treat waste before it's put into a disposal cell might actually result in greater risk if you're dealing with very large, heavily contaminated radiological contamination at a site. So if you can put it in the cell and treat it there, that actually would reduce risk to workers. So that's one example. Also, technical impracticability. This is what I think people talk about the most, like, oh, EPA never issues those waivers. You're never going to get one. Don't even try. That's not exactly true. We do issue them. Each region has issued one or more TI waivers. And what it really is saying is that compliance with the requirement is technically impracticable from an engineering perspective. Now, cost may be considered as part of this, but it can't be the sole reason. And I think that's where a lot of arguments between regulatory agencies and the cleanup agencies happen. So it might be that there's no existing or innovative technologies that can actually address the contamination to attain that ARAR in question, or doing so would be illogical or infeasible from an engineering perspective. Like DNAPL situations in cracked bedrock where you just can't get to it, that might be an example of where it's just illogical or infeasible to get to. Equivalent standard of performance. This is when, say, the reg identifies a specific standard of performance, but there may be an equivalent one that would be just as, if not more, protective or effective. That is a when you would consider this standard. With the one thing to keep in mind, if a state has inconsistently applied a requirement across its sites, then there is a potential argument that could be made that it should not have to apply under this specific remedy. If it's cherry picked, only some sites have complied with it, other sites have had not to comply with it, then that could be justification for a waiver. I want to share some interesting information just to show you that I am serious. We have had over the years a number of ARAR waivers issued at our federal facilities. This is looking at 1992 to 2020 based on EPA's SEMS information, our Superfund Enterprise Management System. So you could see in the 90s, we had quite a number being issued, a little less so for after 2013. Some other information here, technical and practicability and an interim action were the most used waivers. Greater risk, there were two, and equivalent performance, we've issued four. When I say we, I mean the EPA Federal Facilities Program. This does not include private sites, so those would be different numbers. Looking at waivers by region, we can see here that almost each region has had, I misspoke earlier. Not every region has issued one in the federal facilities program, but several have. And that is just showing you really quick. We've had the most so far in region 4 and in region 10. All right, off to you, Deidre, to close us out.
All right, we're gonna make our time, I promise. All right, I'm gonna talk about ARARs post-rod. So freezing ARARs in a rod. If you have a newly promulgated requirement that may leave your protectiveness in question, then these are some of the things that you should think about. And as an example, and it hasn't been done yet, I want to be clear about that, but there's talk about the lead number being lowered. It's just talk right now, but, and this, you know, this could happen with PFAS if we ever, you know, come up with a MCL for that. But at any rate, anytime you're, protectiveness is maybe not protective any longer. These are some of the things you can do. So you need to evaluate it and see if the remedy remains protective when you have this newly promulgated requirement, say if they lower the lead number. And if it's not protective, you'll have to go in and look at the risk based on the new number. Then you'll have to go back in and evaluate, you know, the protection at different, you know, where it, say they lowered it from 400 to 200. I don't know that that's going to happen, but then if anything is between the 200 and 400 number, you're going to have to go back in and evaluate those sites and apply the newly promulgated requirement. But if nothing is, everything's below 200, the new number, then you would call them frozen and everything would be fine and your remedy would still remain protective. But the remedy must be modified if a new ARAR is needed to remain protective. And this can be captured in the explanation of significant differences or in a rod amendment, depending on the scope of how large the action that is needed for your specific site. And I can give you an example. My private site that I have, when the tenants moved into the building, then our need changed. Now, this isn't an ARAR specific need, except that we did have to figure out ARAR numbers, site specific numbers for the VI risk to the tenants. And so I have a vapor mitigation alternative inside the building. And I also have an SVE system, which is pulling out the vapors from underneath the building to ensure protectiveness throughout the remaining action until we have the site investigated completely from a remedial investigation standpoint. So ARARs and five-year reviews. And this is another big, five-year reviews is another big red flag if you have something that needs to be changed. And that's why I love five-year reviews, because it recalls for your review of a site. And if anything has changed, if you notice there's VI or you notice that a number has changed. And sometimes actually Like I just found out from South Carolina that they raised their VI number from one rod to another on the same site. And so we're talking about, you know, looking into that in the future. So it can go either way, but, you know, we'd have to have a reason to reopen the ESD, but, you know, to reopen it and consider an ESD, but any kind of change and a five-year review, actually that it's a common occurrence that you have to go in and look at something differently, evaluate protectiveness standards or, you know, something changed, a wetland. I mean, any kind of change can influence when you reopen your decision document. Some of the questions you'll ask during the five-year review is your remedy functioning as it was intended? Are your exposure assumptions still valid? Do you have a new exposure like a VI path? Do you have, are contaminants now being introduced to a stream that weren't previously? Then your toxicity and cleanup levels, have they changed? Have your remedial action objectives, have they been met? Has it been cleaned up in the time period you initially thought in your rod? If not, you may need to reevaluate your technologies and get a more aggressive technology in place. So you look at all the different things and you have to decide if they're still valid from a protectiveness standpoint. And then that necessitates your review of your ARARs. And so five-year reviews are an opportunity to ensure protectiveness, and it gives you an opportunity to evaluate the implementation and performance of your remedies. And then, you know, if any new information comes, then that's additional that you'll have to look at your remedies and maybe change some ARARs. Or just you noted that you've changed that you've investigated the ARARs and no change was necessary. And we thank you all for participating and being part of our course. And Emmy is the best instructor ever. She developed this course, so.
Thanks, Deidre. So we have our contact information on screen. I know there were a number of questions we couldn't get to today. If you'd like to reach out to me or Deidre separately with a question, just to understand the content better, please feel free to reach out. We're happy to answer questions. And I did want to address something very quickly, I think earlier I may have misspoke and said NEPA when I meant to reference the National Preservation Historic Act as being an ARAR. So apologies for that. Usually the lead cleanup agency is responsible for considering NEPA and they'll do that parallel to the CERCLA process. So apologies if I misspoke on that one. Okay, Jean, I think we're done.
I think we are, Emmy. So with that, I'm going to have those slides stay up there for just one quick second while I swap out the view, and then I'll walk through final closing reminders for everyone. So I do want to echo your thanks to our speakers and the audience who joined us for today's broadcast. I do have just a couple of real quick reminders I'll get through before we close things out, but I want to make sure that everybody has a chance to copy down your contact information if they haven't, in case they wanted to follow up with any other questions that we may not have had time to address during our session today. So with that, I wanted to just remind everybody that we are wrapping up the 11th and final online webinar that is part of the Federal Facilities Online Academy. The preceding 10 webinars, which were already delivered this year, are currently archived and available to play for on-demand replay on the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN.org site. So if you missed any of the earlier 10 sessions, you can replay those. This session will be archived shortly in about 1 or 2 weeks. In about 1 week, we'll have that recording up so you can replay the entire series or point colleagues to it if you would like to share this information. I do want to just remind everybody, if you haven't visited us at the Cleanup Information Network at CLUIN.org, I encourage you to do so. And please be sure to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which I send out on the first of each month that contains information related to cleaning up hazardous waste sites. So we highlight related websites, publications, and both in-person and online training opportunities. The other thing to point out is that if you're looking for that participant manual or collection of related resources, all of that information is contained here on the seminar homepage. So that homepage is shown in red on this URL. It is active from today forward. So even if you're watching a recorded version, you can visit that URL to access materials. And I'll just remind everyone that content is broken up in these little gray sections. So you may need to scroll up and down and use the plus and minus icons to expand or collapse each section. But you will find the webinar slides are posted here as a file known as the participant manual, which contains not only the slides, but related notes. And then we do have a whole collection of related websites on today's topic that have also been posted. Now, if you would like to get a participant based off of your joining today's webinar, I'll ask you to fill out the online feedback form. That feedback form can be found on the seminar homepage. So it's one of the last sections. So you can visit this seminar homepage and fill out that online feedback form. Please make sure that you fill out your email address and check the box on that form certifying you were here for the entire session. And then as soon as you send your feedback in, you'll have access to download or print out a participation certificate. We'll also email a copy to you, but sometimes spam or junk filters catch those emails, so I encourage you to download it from the confirmation screen as soon as you see it. If you happen to join a viewing party or others joined you at your location, even if they didn't register on their own, if you get them the link to that seminar homepage, they can give us their feedback, even though they didn't register individually, and get their own participation certificate. So I encourage you to share that URL if you were the one who registered, so that those who joined you can also share their thoughts to get their own certificate. And if you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying today's archive, right around now in the archive, there should be a button just above my head in the upper right that has a link to that feedback form. So you should be able to click that and open up the same feedback form, give us your feedback based off of replaying the recorded version, making sure you check the box certifying that you did that, and then you can still get a participation certificate for your own records based off your replay. So with that, I want to thank Emmy and all of her instructors, as well as the over 250 individuals who joined us for today's live broadcast. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time, and you will join us on a future seminar. Thank you so very much for joining us. This will be the final
conclusion. 3-day class.
And the 3-day class, that's right. There'll be additional details posted on a separate site for those of you who registered and participated in the online webinars. So thank you, Deidre, for that reminder. And with that, we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you very much for joining us.